It's The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. The United Nations Climate Change Conference is happening this week in Bonn, Germany. And for the first time, the Assembly of First Nations is joining as an official delegate. Indigenous groups from around the world will join to discuss how their traditional knowledge and experience with environmental destruction can be a big asset as the rest of the world tries to figure out what to do about climate change. It's a topic my next two guests have worked on for decades. Victoria Talley-Corpuz is an indigenous leader from the Cordillera region of the Philippines and a UN special rapporteur on the rights of indigenous peoples. And Gleb Radowski is with the Polis Project on ecological governance at the University of Victoria. He's the author of the new book out today called Archipelago of Hope. It documents indigenous communities' lifestyles in the face of climate change and shows, he says, why everyone should pay attention.
Well, first of all, indigenous people have a track record of maintaining their relationship with the land in a way that doesn't kill it, something that we don't really have on our resume. And so for me personally, I'd rather learn from those who actually have such resume that, you know, extends back for millennia and is based on a holistic understanding of people's place in nature.
Victoria, this resume of living with a radically changing environment that Gleb is talking about, how do you convince skeptics that this resume is a resource for indigenous communities and non-indigenous communities that are soon to be coping with climate change?
Well, first of all, I think that there's a lot of evidence that will show now that the last remaining more intact rainforests in the world today are coinciding with that traditional territories of indigenous people. So I think there are maps that have been developed that will show these overlaps. And I think that's one way to convince skeptics to show this map and to show that these areas where the ecosystem is in a better shape are areas where indigenous peoples live as well. And in areas where their rights to these territories are respected, the level of protection of these forests and nature reserves are higher compared to the ones which have been managed even by the states and, of course, by others. And the second thing is, of course, to also show that the indigenous peoples who live in these ecosystems which are in better shape are living more simply, and they are living in relationship with the nature around them.
And their traditional territories represent more than 20% of the global land area and contain close to 80% of the world's biological diversity. But yet their rights are recognized only on one-fifth of those territories. So if you really want to take heed to the messages that indigenous peoples are generously sharing with us, we should do everything possible for our own sake to recognize their rights.
Gleb, you didn't write your book to document environmental degradation, but you visited so many different communities around the world who have experience with environmental degradation that might be a lesson to the rest of the world as it confronts the realities of climate change. Tell me about people in the Russian Arctic and the annual reindeer summer migration there.
It's one of the longest, or probably the longest, annual migration still in existence in the world. It's about 800 miles. And over the last 20 or 30 years, that migration has been gradually disrupted by gas and oil development that's been taking place on the peninsula. It's an important source of natural gas for Russian state, for Russian state company Gazprom. And so the story was how this development has been impacting the annual cycle, but also how new challenges of climate change, melting permafrost, are impacting their way of life, and how, despite all of that, they still remain certain that if they are allowed to continue with their traditional migration, relying on their reindeer, they have a good future ahead of them.
Victoria, you've been hard at work your entire career getting those voices heard at the UN and other places. You helped draft the Declaration on Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 1993. It wasn't even adapted in the UN until 2007. What's been your own experience in the difficulty, the challenge, I'll say, in getting indigenous peoples' voices heard when it comes to questions of the environment?
Well, I think that generally indigenous peoples have always been in situations where they are silenced or their issues are not paid attention to by governments at the national level as well as at the global level. And I think the main reason is because the message that they want to tell the world is something that will show how dominant the modern thinking is to the point that they would like to denigrate the contributions of indigenous peoples in sustaining the world's remaining ecosystem. And of course, the dominant voices are more partial to so-called modernization and progress, which is something that indigenous peoples are subjected to, and it's the reason why they are also being repressed and marginalized.
Well, Victoria, here's an extremely practical idea. If these are people who come from communities with a long experience of living in concert with the land and taking a holistic approach to environmental management, it seems like they would be pretty good job candidates to help local governments run their own environmental policies.
Yes, that would really be very reasonable, but in actual reality, that's not the case. You know, in fact, in some areas, indigenous peoples are even kept away. They are displaced from the national parks that have been designated as such. And in some instances, there are good examples, like, for instance, in Australia, there are indigenous peoples who are doing co-management. But that's not a common thing to see. But I would say that if governments realize that this is really one of the better ways to keep the environment in a better shape, then, of course, it makes a lot of sense for them to involve them and to hire them and even to compensate them for doing the things that they do anyway.
So, Gleb, each of these stories is different. They're unique, in some ways not related, but it seems to me that each of these communities is a place that has dealt with and adapted to radical changes in the environment. The rest of the world, perhaps for the first time, is confronting radical change in its own environment because of climate change. But it seems to me there's some collective experience here that people outside of indigenous communities can learn from.
The main message is that everything is connected, and you are, as a community, as a human being, are part of this web of life, and you have to act accordingly. You don't treat it as your source of revenue, but you treat it as a neighbor, as a relative, as a living, breathing, spiritual entity that you have to maintain a respectful relationship with.
Victoria Talley-Korpuz, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Gleb Rigorodetsky, thanks to you as well.
Pleasure. Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.